Now we're holding on Kuf Samach Zayin Amud Beis, five lines from the bottom. We learned in the Mishnah that the sofer is allowed to write a shover. In Hebrew, it's called shover. In Aramaic, as we're going to see in the following story, it's called tavra, because we know we often have a shin in Hebrew and a tof in Aramaic or cognates. Anyway, so we said in the Mishnah, you're allowed to write a shover for a shover being a receipt for the value of the ksuba. You can write it for the wife, even when her husband is not with her, because it's the only thing, she's the one who stands to lose if it gets lost, and her husband finds it and claims it that he used it to pay the ksuba. So fine, if she wants to take that chance, then that's fine. We said, as we learned yesterday in the Gemara, the Edim and the Sofer do have to recognize that this woman is, and that in fact she's married to this man, but once they do that, that was named in the Shtar, but once they do that, then they can write it even when he's not present. So the Gemara tells, Hahu Tavra, there was a shover, to have a chosmala, Rabbi Yumi Yaba'aba. Rabbi Yumi Yaba'aba was one of the Edim who had signed on it. Asil Kamehai Hihitza, of the woman named in the Shtar, came in front of Rabbi Yumi. Omrulay, she says, Lava no havoi, she says to him, that wasn't me. That was there must have been another woman of my, there must have been. And so she comes to collect her, so she comes, not with that Shtar, that's the, she comes to collect her ksuba after her husband divorced her or died, and she says, I know there's a shover out there with my name on it. And that you signed it, but it wasn't me. There must have been some other woman with the same name as me, and who has the same husband's name as me, and that had it written in order to mess things up for me. But I haven't actually had my ksuba paid off yet. Omar, sort of Yumi Ba'aba says, I'm not Nami, I'm Lahu Lav Ihi. Actually, I had also, when I was, I had told the Edom at the time, that it wasn't you. The Omruli, and they told, so I told them, I think you're right. It is somebody else. The Omruli, and they told me, the other Edim, make a shuda koshala. No, all it is she's gotten older, ubogo la kola, and her voice has changed with age, and therefore that's why you don't recognize her. But in fact, it is you. So the way the Rashbam explains, in other words, that where Rabbi Yumi Ba'aba is telling her, I know you're claiming it wasn't you, but in fact it was you. The only reason there's any possibility of thinking otherwise is I myself actually thought originally that it wasn't you, and they told me that it was. So now I'm telling you this shover was in fact you. And therefore, even though the shover has her name on it. So the Rashbam learns, in other words, that basically what he's saying is, originally I had said it's not you, and therefore you have a valid point, but now he's saying, now I realize it was you after all, and it's just that your voice changed. Omer Abaya, so Abaya comments on that, Afagav de Omer Rabbanan, even though the Chachamim tell us, based on the Pasuk says, Im lo yagid v'nosa avoyna, the Pasuk says, if an aide does not come and tell his testimony and based in what he's supposed to, then he's guilty for causing justice to not be done, and in certain cases, he's actually kind of a korban for it, as we will learn in Masechta Shavuos a few months from now, Be'ez Hashem. In any case, we learn from that Pasuk, a concept, Kivin Shehigid Shuvenich once an aide has said his aedus in Beis Din, he can't again say something that which will contradict his original statement. But says Abaya, when it comes to a Surah Merabonon literally means a young Talmud Chacham. There's no particular indication that Rabbi Yumi Ba'aba was young in this case. So Surah Merabonon, it seems, is just being used in the general sense of a Talmud Chacham. Lav Orcha LeMedak, it's not general for him, it's not usual for him to specifically go and recognize women, it wouldn't be tzniyistik, so therefore, so it's not considered kivin shehigid, shuvein chazer magid, for him to retract and say that originally he made a mistake, that at first he thought that it was someone else, and now, that it was someone else, and now they tell him that it's her. So in other words, what happened was over here, so to clarify, she had said, When she says it wasn't me, it's somebody else who impersonated me, who has the same name as me and my husband, Rabbi Yirmiyahu Bar Abba is saying, at first I also thought that you're telling the truth. Then the other Edim who were with me came and told me that in fact it was you, and just I didn't recognize you. And as a Talmud Chacham, I'm not expected to. And so that, as Abaye is pointing out, and therefore in fact you don't have the right to collect your ksuba, because it seems from the evidence available to me that in fact it is you, and that in fact it is you, and you are entitled to collect, and therefore your ksuba has already been claimed. That's the way the Rashbam learns. The Rashash actually suggests that it might actually be the other way around. That Rabbi Yirmiyahu is saying that when I was originally going to sign, then yeah, I thought that it was somebody else, and the other Edim told me that it was you, and therefore, in other words, in the Rashbam's explanation, Rabbi Yirmiyahu is saying I had originally told the other Edim that no, this must be a different woman, and then they told me that no, it is the same woman, you're making a mistake, you just didn't recognize her because since you signed the receipt, and now when she came to Beis Din, she's older, and her voice has changed, so therefore, so Rabbi Yirmiyahu is saying, so after all, I do agree with the other Edim, and was saying that usually, even Kivin Shehigid, Shuvein Chozer Magid, but in the first place, as a Talmud Chacham, he wasn't necessarily expected to recognize her so well. The Rashash actually talks about that maybe, he says that's a bit of a doichik, and he says maybe it's the other way around. He says that when I originally signed it, I didn't think that it was you, and the other Edim told me that it was when I signed it. So now I realize in fact that I'd been misled by those Edim, and in fact it wasn't you, and therefore you are entitled to your ksuba. And therefore, again, the idea being, as a Talmud Chacham, we don't expect him to be recognizing women so closely. He mentions in Imukah Yosef, which also on the Rif, which also gives a somewhat similar explanation. The Gemara continues with a case like that in reverse. Hahu Tavra to have a chosim alei Rabbi Yirmiyahu Bar Abba. There was another shover that Rabbi Yirmiyahu Bar Abba was signed on as one of the edim. Omra lei, and again the woman comes and claims lava no havoi. It wasn't me, and I haven't collected my ksuba yet. Omra lo, and Rabbi Yirmiyahu tells her ivra. As a matter of fact, yes, definitively, ant havas, it was you. So don't claim that it was somebody else. Omra Abaya, so Abaya comments on that. Even though, as we just said, a Talmud Chacham is not usually one who's going to look carefully at women and then make a point of recognizing them, because not tzniyistik. Nevertheless, given the doc, if he did make sure to particularly recognize a certain woman, then we can accept that what he said is so. And therefore, in other words, in this case, Rabbi Yirmiyahu Bar Abba is saying, the fact is, I took trouble to make sure to make sure who it is. So now we can say that we can accept him at his word, and in fact it is her, and she has no right to, she has no further right to collect the ksuba, because after all there was a shover out there that her husband is bringing with her name on it, and we don't believe her to say that there was somebody else with that name. Which Tosfos says, in other words, the point is, so Tosfos asks the question then, in that case, what do you mean? Where he said it's not her, as in the first case, and was saying that he can change his mind, how much more so when he says to begin with, this is her, then we believe him, then we believe him. And the answer is, that's what it means. Given the duck means that in both, it means, it actually, that would apply in both cases. We would say, a Talmud Chacham, if he does take the trouble to notice a particular woman, and he says, I can be 100% sure that it was you, then we take him, then we trust him, and we say he can, and then we would say the usual rule, kivin shehigid shuvein chozer magid, then we would say once he's testified a certain way, he can't change his mind and say the other way around. only in the first case where he himself is saying, the truth is I was uncertain at the time, that's when we would say that we can attribute that to the fact that at the time of Chacham, he wouldn't look closely at her. Again, the Rashash in his explanation points out that his explanation, that of Nemuka Yosef, which is based on, kind of avoids the question in the first place. Because according to his explanation, the first case, he never thought in the first place that it was her. He was just misled by the Aiden. As opposed to in the second case, he is certain that it is her, and therefore we don't believe him later on to say that he made a mistake. If he were to say that later on. Okay. So in this connection, the Gemara brings, by the way, Omar Abaya, Hait Suvim and Abanan, a Tamil Chacham, or specifically again, a young Tamil Chacham, the Ozal Kadushi Ipsa, when he's going to be Mekadosh a woman, and he has never seen her before necessarily, he should bring along an Ama Oretz with him to recognize her. Because otherwise they might switch her for another wife, for another woman, without him noticing. So Talmud Chacham, as we're saying, does not usually look at women to recognize them. Therefore, we have to be concerned that he might in fact not take the trouble to look at her carefully, and therefore later on when he comes back to marry her, before they make the kedushin or whatever, they're gonna swap her out with somebody else, like Lavan did with Rachel and Leah. So therefore you should have along an Ama Oretz, because an Ama Oretz is not so sneer-stiff and is not going to and will look at her and he'll be able to tell him, then he'll be able to tell the Talmud Chacham, the chassan, that this is in fact the same woman or that it's not. An interesting point in this connection is, now the Rambam writes the halacha that you are, even though normally you're not allowed to look at women, a man is allowed to look at a woman to decide, whether he likes her looks and whether he wants to marry her. I mean, there are many, obviously looks are not the only thing you should marry for, but nevertheless, you know, you do have to be physically attracted to your spouse, so looks do have a certain importance. And the Rambam writes that even though normally you're not allowed to look at women, but you are in this case. The Ravid says, what are you talking about? You see that this Gemara is saying that the Talmud Chacham should bring along the Amoretz to do that for him. So the Magen Mishnah in turn points out, listen, you know, and according to the Ravid, if you're telling me it's flat out Osir, so what is a Talmud Chacham allowed to tell an Amoretz to do something that's Osir? Obviously, it must not be actually Osir. We're just saying that a Talmud Chacham... In fact, the Rambam is right. There's no issue involved. But because a Talmud Chacham doesn't often look at women, he doesn't really have a standard against which to judge is this woman beautiful or not. So therefore, the Ama Oretz, on the other hand, who doesn't have a problem looking at women, he'll be able to be more objective about it. To know whether in fact she's attractive or not. There's different explanations, different Noisa Kalim on the Rambam, in fact, that deal with various angles. The Rambam doesn't bring this point at all. The Rambam brings just again that you are allowed to look at a Pnuya, and he doesn't mention this point about that. The Talmud Chacham taking along the Ama Oretz. So there's a number of, besides for the Magen Mishnah's explanation, there's a number of explanations among the Noisa Kalim of the Rambam about Taka, why doesn't he bring the Halacha in the first place that you should bring along the Ama Oretz. So one distinction is that the Migdal Oiz mentions over there because the Rambam is Taka not discussing Talmud Chachamim in the first place, and furthermore, you could say there's a difference whether he's already engaged to her, whether they've already made Shiduchim versus not. He's talking about, in other words, before you've even made the Shidduch. So therefore, yes, so Talmud Chacham shouldn't be looking at her, have an Ama Oretz do it instead, as opposed to when the Rambam says you're allowed to look at a Pnuya, it's talking about after the Shidduch has been made. In any case, the point is, even though we're saying in this Gemara, even though a Talmud Chacham usually doesn't look at women to gauge their appearance, nevertheless, that doesn't mean that we prevent him from saying Eidos about a woman at all. In the case of Rabbi Yirmiyahu Abba before, we did accept his Eidos, We just said that in the first case he would be able to change his mind, because most of the time it's not, there's not going to be a mistake. If he says I made a mistake, then and again in the first case involving Rabbi Yirmiyahu ben Abba, he himself was saying I was uncertain in the first place. Then we say he's allowed to change his mind. It's not kivin shehigid shulein achozer or magid. But again, even with him, as Tosfos says, if he said for sure I know for sure, then there's no change in his mind. And after all, most of the time a Talmid Chacham is going to at least casually recognize the woman that we're talking about.
It seems incongruent to say that you're allowed to look at a woman, even in the case of marriage, when the Torah itself mentions about Sarah that she was beautiful looking, and I think about it's a contradiction. It doesn't
make
any sense.
Well, as a matter of fact, actually, we have Rashi mentioning on the Pasuk when they're going to Mitzrayim, and Avraham says, Hine no yodaiti, behold, now I know that you're a beautiful woman. And you have what Rashi mentions over there, that he had never looked at her so thoroughly to know that she's beautiful until now. But again, we're saying that, there is a point, in other words, al pi halacha, you're not allowed to sam look at women, but where there's a teilus for it, where there's a purpose for it. For example, as far as Eidos, so for example, as we're saying over here, as far as making sure that he's marrying the right woman, then there is a certain degree of leeway for that. All the same, we're saying that Talmid Chacham, instead of relying on his own judgment, and again, as the Magid Mishnah is saying on the Rambam, he doesn't really have a standard to compare against. So then, let him have an Amah Oretz to help him make that decision.
That's all fine, but where does the halacha base itself on which grounds, when the Torah itself mentions, the beauty of Sarah or
well, the fact that it says the beauty of Sarah doesn't mean that Avraham looked at her, as I just mentioned from Rashi. You actually have the one thing that's brought in that connection is a pasuk in Eov, where Eov says on himself, "Mars bonin al basula, when would I even look at an unmarried girl?" And we learn from that lahalacha that it's not proper to be looking, that's not sneistic to be looking at women unless there's a particular reason involved. Sarah and Avraham were already married for many years by that point, and we still see that Avraham hadn't gazed at her. But yeah.
Right. What about Rivka and Yitzchak? I mean,
what about
she looked
Yitzchak,
to them?
Yitzchak, when Rivka catches sight of Yitzchak, then Latika Hatzoy Fatiskas, the pasuk says she took a veil and veiled herself. So at some point, Yitzchak had to have seen her, obviously, if nothing else. At some point, Yitzchak had to have seen her, but we don't know whether that was before or after they got married.
The halacha should be the other way around. You should not be allowed to marry a woman without seeing her.
There is a halacha that says, Osulo la'odim shi'kadisha ta'isha, that a man is not allowed to be makadish a woman until he knows that, until he's seen her to the extent that he knows that he wants to marry her. Because you have an Indian of ve'ahavta kamocha, you don't want to have that he's going to marry her, find that she's unattractive, and that he's not going to like her. So there is that factor as well. It's true. So how do we reconcile? So that's what we're saying. So one thing over here is that so you do have, on the one hand, he does have to look in order to know that there's something shemayir ba'ein of Dovah Megunah, because he might see something unattractive on her. On the other hand, you're not supposed to, and v'nishmar to mekol davar ra. So yeah, that's what I'm saying. So you have various explanations that there's a difference between gazing, staring at her, like, versus giving a glance. So the Gemara in Kiddushin would mean that you should give a glance at least. So you're doing it, so that's one explanation, is that Rambam is talking about on the one hand, you are supposed to look at her mutter. So when the Rambam uses the expression mutter leistakel, which leistakel means to gaze at her. So therefore, so we're saying that you're allowed to, but Talmid Chachamim would try to avoid that as well. And therefore, we're saying over here in the Gemara that he's going to need an Amah Oretz to help him out, because a Talmid Chacham does not really have a standard to gauge against. He's not going to know the difference between an attractive woman and an unattractive one, and he's not going to recognize if they end up switching her out for somebody else, whereas an Amah Oretz doesn't do that Chumrah. He won't gaze at her either, because that's flat out also, but he will at least look at her and be able to recognize her. That's one point. So that's one point to recognize. Reconcile them. So there's a tension, as there often is in halacha, between different contradictory and some slash overlapping considerations. On the one hand, we need to be careful of Pnius, and on the other hand, we want to make sure that there's an attraction between husband and wife and that they don't swap them out.
I think it should be the other way around. Let's go on over here.
This is how it is, and this is how it is, and if we want, we can discuss it later. But yeah. Okay.
It should be the other way around.
Okay, I understand what you're saying. I understand what you're saying. The fact is that this is how the Rambam formulates the relevant halachas. You're not allowed to look at women. You are allowed to stackle. You're allowed to gaze at a penuria to know whether you want to marry her. And you have these different explanations about what's allowed and what a Talmud Chacham is machmir on himself.
I think the halacha does, the Rambam doesn't make a difference between someone who's married and someone who's not married.
Okay, the Rambam says flat out that you're not allowed to look at a woman, but he says you're allowed to look at a penuria, you're allowed to at least stackle at a penuria to know whether you want to marry her. No, it doesn't make a difference, married or not. A married man has a Yetzirah as well. You have a story of Abba Chilkiah, the grandson of Choni Ma'agel in the Sefta Tainis, where he's working hard all day in the fields, and then he comes home and his wife comes out all beautifully made up and bejeweled and whatever to see him, to greet him, and afterwards he's explaining to the Chachamim who had come to him to ask him to daven for rain. He says to them that I want to go. She does that so that I don't look at any other women because he foretells a Yetzirah, and he needs to take steps to make sure that his Yetzirah doesn't cause him to look at other women like this. When she comes out like this, then he'll have eyes only for her. All right. As I said, we need to go on. If you want to discuss this later, we can discuss this later. Okay. The Mishnah had said this, so we discussed with each of the various kinds of shtaris that are mentioned in the Mishnah. We said, at each shtar, there's a rule in halacha who should be paying for the sofer. We said in the Mishnah, when it comes to writing a get, the husband should be paying the sofer. When it comes to a shover, so now we learned two different explanations yesterday between Rabbi Gershom and Rashbam, whether the husband pays for the writing of the shover or not, or does it mean that generally the wife pays for the shover? And similarly, with each of the other shtaris mentioned in the Mishnah, we had who pays. So now the Gemara goes through them. We said the husband pays the sofer for writing the get. My timer. So why is that? Because the pasuk says the husband has to write the get and he has to give it to her. So now he himself is not writing the get. He himself nowadays is delegating it to the sofer. But nevertheless, we still need that. We still need. That he should be paying for the sofer, and that way it can be considered as though basically the sofer is writing it on his behalf. So the Gemara points out for idna delay of din and hachi. Nowadays we don't do that. Nowadays, we often have that the wife pays for the sofer. Why is that? Because the Chachamim imposed instead that it should be on the wife, that she should be the one paying it, and it's for her good. That way he does not delay giving the get. In other words, what might happen is if he has to pay, then he might stall and not give the get in time, and then meanwhile she's going to be stuck. So therefore, for her benefit, the Chachamim said, let her pay the sofer, and she's generally the one who wants to get divorced, and therefore she'll pay the sofer. Nevertheless, though, what we do basically is that So the Ramban learns that basically then the Chachamim are still makne the woman herself tells the sofer to be makne to get to the husband, and that way it's his when he gives it to her. The Nemuk Yosef says that's actually not necessary, but nonetheless part of the process of writing a get nowadays is that the husband explicitly appoints the sofer as his shliach, and he officially makes a kinyan on the get before he gives it to her. In fact, elsewhere, the Gemara points that out. There's a Gemara in Gittin where the Chista says that, in principle, you could argue that any get that's given nowadays is possible, because after all, the Torah says he should give it, he should write it, and the husband doesn't write it himself. Usually it's the wife who pays the sofer, but the Gemara says over there, Rava says, okay, fine, but nevertheless, the Chachamim are makne, the pruto, or the get, the zuz, whatever the amount of money that's paid to the sofer, the Chachamim are makne to him, so this way, as we're saying in the Gemara over here, this way there's no delay. He doesn't say, well, I don't want to pay that zuz, therefore I'm not going to give the get. And nevertheless, though, the Chachamim are makne to him in order to be Mekayim, because of that he writes the get. Okay. Next, we said in the Mishnah, Kosvin Shtar Loi V'Afishen Malva Imo. We said you can write a shtar of a loan for a loiva even if the malva is not with them, Bechola. And we said that the loiva is the one who pays for the shtar to be written. So the Gemara says, Pshita, obviously, the loiva is the one who wants to borrow the money, and the malva is not getting any hana from this loan. So why would we think that he has to pay? The Mishnah has to tell us otherwise. And the answer is loy tzricha beiska. You're right. The chiddush of the Mishnah is that we're talking about not a regular loan, but rather an iska, where you have Reuven is investing money with Shimon, where Shimon is going to be the actual managing partner. He's going to open a store or whatever with that money, and then divide the profits with Reuven. We learned about it in Bava Metzia about how it has to be structured to avoid issues of ribis. The point being, in other words, that we learned over there that such a thing, such an iska like that, is because the chacham and consider it half milva, half pikadin, half the money is considered a loan, meaning that Shimon is going to be on the hook for it no matter what, the same as you always are for a loan. The other half is considered a pikadin, and therefore if he ends up losing that part of the investment, then he can say that it was an onus, he can say that he was a shomer, and he's potter from onus, as we learned extensively in the Gemara and Bava Metzia. The point is that here Reuven, the investor, is getting some benefit from it, because after all, the point is he's giving this money to Shimon to invest, and he's going to get some of the profits. So you would think maybe that he should participate in the fee for writing the shtar, and the Mishnah is saying that no, nevertheless Shimon, the managing partner, is the one who's having the greater benefit, and therefore he's the one who has to pay to have the shtar written. Obviously, if they agree mutually among themselves otherwise, then they can do whatever they want, but we're talking about over here by default how it has to be. Next, Kosven Shtar Lemoicher Afishen Lekeach Bechola. We said you can write a shtar for the seller of a field, for example, even though the Lekeach is not with him, and it's the Lekeach who pays the sofer. So again, the Gemara asks Pshita, obviously, why would he think the seller has to pay the sofer? He's not the one who's gaining as much from it. And the answer is, the Chiddush is, let's say the seller is selling his field because it's bad. Because, for example, it has a big moom in it, so he wants to unload it, or, for example, it's further away from his house and it's a bother for him to get to. So you would think that maybe, after all, he is getting a hana over there. So therefore, the Rashbam refers to a pasuk and a Gemara on the subject that sometimes you are better off selling than you are buying. Nevertheless, the Lekeach is still getting the greater hana, and therefore he's the one who has to write the shtar. In between, by the way, in between the get and the selling of the field, we did have another case in the Mishnah. We mentioned that the shover can be written for the woman, even though her husband is not with him. Although vavshi hey makiran, provided again that the sofer and the edim recognize them, as we talked about in the Gemara yesterday, what exactly they need to recognize. Now the Rashbam mentions over here there existed a girsa in front of him, which is the girsa of Rabbeinu Hananah, which is the girsa rather of Rabbeinu Gershom, that adds a piece in the Gemara over here that discusses about the shover that the Gemara had asked. About the shover, isn't it obvious about the receipt for the ksuba? Isn't it obvious that the wife has to pay for that because she's the one who has the benefit from it, because she's now able to eventually she's going to use it to collect her ksuba, and then she's going to give the receipt to her husband. So Rabbeinu Gershom's girsa actually. Is that
excuse me, that the Gemara is asking why, in fact, Rabbeinu Gershom's Girsa in the Mishnah had been that when it comes to the Shoiver, the husband pays for it. So the Gemara asked why. The Gemara had, so according to his Girsa, the Gemara is asking over here, why shouldn't the woman be paying for it? Because after all, this is, she's giving the Shoiver to her husband, and only then is she going to collect her Ksuba. With no Shoiver, he's going to say, I don't have to pay off your Ksuba, because you're just going to go and try to collect her from me again. So he has a girsa over here in the Gemara that the Gemara mentions it because having mentioned in the Reisha that the husband pays the shofar, so for the get, so it mentions also that he pays for the shofar as well. That's Rabbeinu Gershom's girsa. The Rashbam mentions that girsa, but he says that no, you're not going to have the Mishnah is not going to tell us something in the Sefer which is wrong because just in order to be parallel with the Reisha, so it must be that in fact no, there's nothing like that. Rather, all we're saying, so that whole part is left out of the Gemara. In fact, the Mishnah had said, Ro'isha Nesen Eschar actually does go on both the, Avah Baal Nesen Eschar was going only on the get. The Shoiver, in fact, most of the time the woman would pay for because she's the one who needs it in order to be able to collect her Ksuba. So according to the Rashbam, the Gemara is B'chlal not bothered, but is not bothered by that concept. Next, we continue in the Mishnah. Ein kosvin shtar erusin v'chola. We said that a shtar erusin and a shtar nisuin can be written only with the consent of both the husband and the wife, or both the chosen and the kala, or their parents, respectively. And we said the chosen is the one who pays for the shtar to be written. Now, we talked about yesterday, there's two possibilities what we mean by a shtar erusin. We can mean what we call nowadays tznoyim, which is where the chosin and kala's families agree between themselves what the conditions are going to be under which the marriage is going to take place, who's going to pay for what, etc. Or we could have, it means a shtar where the husband, where the chosin writes out how they act mekudeshesly and he's mekadesh with that shtar. In any case, the Gemara asks Pshita, isn't that obvious that the chosin would be the one who pays for it? So it's like this. If the shtari erusin we're talking about is the tnoim, then the Pshita in the Gemara is focused on the fact that the Mishnah had said that you need the consent of both of them to write it. Unlike the get and the shover and the shtaris that we talked about until now, where it's possible to have them written unilaterally because one side stands to lose out if he loses them, so if he wants to take that chance, or she wants to take that chance, here with a shtar erusin, both of them are taking on responsibilities, so therefore both of them have to agree. So according to that, the Gemara is asking Pshita, isn't that obvious since they're both taking on responsibilities, they both have to agree. According to the understanding that we're talking about a shtar of kiddushin, a shtar that says hareat mekudeshesli, then the question of the pshita is, isn't it obvious that the chosin would have to pay for writing that, because after all, he's the one who gets the hanah from it. So that's Rabbeinu Gershom's understanding of the Gemara. Anyway, the Gemara answers, Loit Stricha, Dafil Ksuvim and Abanam. The Chiddush is, even if the Chosin, as a Tamad Chacham, the Nichale Lachamur, the Karuvi, his father in law is going to really want to have him as a Tamad Chacham. To have a Tamad Chacham as a husband for your daughter is a very good thing indeed. So therefore, you would think that maybe now, therefore, the father in law, the parents in law, are really, they have a greater Hana, and therefore, maybe we would say that he should pay for the whole thing because he's gaining that benefit of having a Tamar Chacham as a son in law. Nevertheless, the Mishnah is telling us that, nevertheless, the Chosin is the one who pays for the Shtar. And according to Rabbeinu Gershom, because we're talking about a shtar kiddushin, then the point is, you could argue that the father-in-law is gaining the great benefit, and maybe you shouldn't even need the wife's consent or her parents' consent to even write a shtar kiddushin to the kaddish in the first place. Nevertheless, you do. The Mishnah is telling us.
You can't argue against that the anah of the future husband is much greater than the anah of the father-in-law, and therefore he should pay.
Well, ultimately, that would be the reason why the Mishnah is telling us that. But the point is, there is that chiddush, you wouldn't have realized it without the Mishnah telling us, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, but we don't know that the Mishnah's reason is that reason. The Mishnah
well,
is just saying...
The Mishnah is telling us that the chosen has to pay, and the Mishnah is telling us that it has to be mutually agreed to write the shtar. So we're asking, is pshita, and the answer is, and the answer is that. Right, you could argue how it would have been otherwise, but the point is now the Mishnah is telling us in order to forestall any possible logic that you might think otherwise, maybe because, like you're saying, after all, the chosen is ultimately the one with the greater hanai. Okay.
Right.
Right. We said in the Mishnah, Ein kos v'shtar arisus v'kablonus chula. We said that a shtar of arisus, where a person is agreeing that he's going to be an artist for somebody else, or a kablon for somebody else, he's going to work his field, and he's going to give him a percentage or a fixed share of the crops. So you have to write such a shtar also only with the das of both of them. And we said the worker is going to be the one who pays the schar of the sofer. So again, the question is, pshita, isn't that obvious? He's getting the main hana from getting this deal because now he has an income stream for the next few years. So why would we think that he wouldn't pay for the shtar? The answer is, like Sricha, the bura. The chiddush of the Mishnah is, even where the field has to be left fallow for some time. So we're talking about he's not going to be right away going and working the field. He's going to have to leave it for a while, so he's going to have to leave it for a year or two, fallow, before he starts working it. So right now he's not having any hana for the next year or two. Nevertheless, he still has to write the shtar because eventually, in the longer term, he is going to have that hana. Again, Rabbeinu Gershom has a different explanation over here, that what we mean is, in other words, we're talking about, let's say the field has been fallow for quite some time, so you would think at this point, now the balabas is having ana, he's finally found an artist who's gonna work the field for him and is gonna make profit from it, so therefore maybe we should put the responsibility on him to pay for the shtar. Nevertheless, it's the makabel, it's the tenant farmer who still stands to gain more from it. Then we said, Ein Kosvin started Beirubin Elamidas Shnehen. We said that another din is that you write when it comes to a Shtar Beirubin, then, which we're going to explain in a second what that is, then you need the consent of both of them to write it. So the Gemara asked, my started Beirubin, what exactly are started Beirubin? So the Gemara gives two answers, which actually both of them are valid. They're not necessarily, The Yad Ramah points out the two answers that we're going to have over here are not necessarily arguing, but rather they are in fact talking about two things, both of which can be called Shtore Beirin. Hocha Taugimu, here in Bavel, they explain Shtore Tanosa. It means Shtores of Tainus. What you have is, in Beis Din, each side is going to be making their claims. And then Beis Din writes a record of what they said, what they claimed in Beis Din, so they can't retract their claims later on. Now both of them stand to lose by that because each one now he might prefer that his arguments are not written down because that way he has a chance to finagle later and to claim that he didn't say that. So therefore we need the consent of both of them in order to make an official record of that. Rabbi Yirmi Ba'aba Omar. Rabbi Yirmi Ba'aba Omer, Zeboro Loi Echad. Rabbi Yirmi Ba'aba says another meaning of Shtori Boros is where you have what's called a Zabla Beis Din. We're going to learn about it in a few weeks, that's the Shem and Sanhedrin. You can have, normally you have a regular Beis Din that sits, you have the Shtot Rabbonim or whatever who constitute a Beis Din. Sometimes you can put together an ad hoc Beis Din where it's called Zeboro Loi Echad. Each one of the Balei Din picks one Dayan that he wants to sit on the panel, and then you have a Machloikas and a Mishnah who picks the third one, whether the two of them mutually pick the third one, or whether the two Dayanim pick the third one. In any case, that kind of Beis Din is called Zeboro Le'echad. The Zeboro Le'echad, they have them nowadays also. They call it a Zabla Beis Din for short. It stands for Zeboro Le'echad. The point is, you need to write down which one you need to write down that Pliny picked Pliny as his Dayan, as his choice for Dayan on this panel, and Pliny picked Pliny, and that way they can't change their mind later and say I didn't actually agree to have this person sit on the panel or whatever. So that would be another meaning of Shtore Boros, of Shtore Beirin, that we have that kind of description. So fine.
Now, the Mishnah had continued, Rav Shimon Gamliel Omer, the Shneim Kosman Shneim Lozela Atzmo Velozeba Atzmo. Rav Shimon Gamliel had said that you write out two separate shtores. When it comes to Shore Beirin, you write out a separate document for each one of them. Now here, the Pashtus, we're talking about with their claims. So here we're talking about, according to the first explanation, that Shore Beirin are where we write down all their claims in Beistin. So Rav Shimon Gamliel is saying that each one gets their own copy of it. So the question is, Lema b'koifin al midas zon kamichli. Should we have to say that Rav Shimon Gamliel and the Tanakhama are arguing on the point of whether koifin al midas zon? When we have something, midas zon, after all, we know from Pirkei Avos is that I don't want to forgive you at all. Or when we have shali shali, shalach shalach, I'll keep mine, you'll keep yours. Yes, Shemim, zon midas zon. So now, in other words, what would happen is the Tanakhama would say, that you, the both of them together, as the Mishnah had said, jointly pay for the sefer, and they have a joint copy that contains both of their arguments. And the Tanakhama would hold that that's what you do. And if one of them says, no, I don't want to have to pay because I would rather have my own, I would rather have separate shtaris for each one, shali shali, shalach shalach, you'll have a document with your claims, I'll have a document with my claims, then the Tanakhama would say that we don't do that because that's midas zorim. So here, in other words, the point is that Ashbam seems to be understanding we're using midas zoyim in a somewhat different sense as we usually use it in the Gemara. Usually when we say in the Gemara, koifin al midas zoyim, and we had it a few times in our Masechta, for example, means where you have, you the other person stands to gain, you don't stand to lose anything, and therefore we're going to force you to do the right thing and not say, well, I can't forgive that you should have. Here it seems to be more along the lines of that he's going to say, like that version of midas zoyim and Pirkei Avos, you know what? I want mine, you want yours. So each of us will have our own shtar that has our own arguments. The Chacham would say that we tell them nothing doing. You have to accept that there's going to be one common shtar that has both of your arguments. So the Tanakhama would hold that we force them to accept that and to both pay for one joint copy. Or Mar Sava Ein Koifin, whereas Reb Shimon Gamliel would hold that we don't. So is that what it means? The Gemara says, no, to call it Alma Koifin, everybody would agree that in a case like that, that if it was just that, we would force them to both accept. But the point is, Reb Shimon Gamliel holds, it's not a matter of midas zoyim over here because the one who wants differently has a valid reason. The Hocha, Hainu Taimid, Reb Shimon Gamliel's reasoning is based like this. The Omar Le, the one says to the other, I don't want that the arguments that you're using in your defense should be written together with mine, and there's only going to be one copy of it, and each of us is able to see it. You are to me like a lurking lion. In other words, I know what's going to happen. You're going to see my arguments, and you're going to start thinking them over and thinking of how you can refute my arguments. And you're a quarrelsome person, that Ashbam paraphrases, and therefore you're going to try to find every opportunity with my arguments written out in front of you. You're going to try every opportunity to find some way of undercutting me. So therefore, I don't want it. Ramban actually asks, well, in that case, then that's a very good point. Why would the Tanakhama even disagree with that? So the Ramban explains, we're talking about over here, one of them says, you know what, we're both paid jointly for the shtar, which means, therefore, both of our arguments will be written in it. As far as you're concerned, fine, you'll hold on to the shtar, and if I need it, then I'll come and borrow it from you. So that wouldn't be midas zoyim, because most of the time he's going to have it. Nevertheless, Rav Shimon Gamliel says, you know what, you're going to use as an excuse and say that you want to borrow the shtar, and you're going to delve into it very carefully in order that now you're able to find new arguments against me, and I don't want that. So that's the reasoning behind the machlokas of whether we should have separate records for each one of them of what they said and based in versus not. Mishnah says, just further on the topic of shtaris, Misha Pora Miktas Choyvei, a person paid off part of his debt. The Hishlish Shtaroi, and he deposited the Shtar for safekeeping with a third party. So the Malva, so now the Loiva doesn't want the Malva to hold on to the Shtar, because then now the Malva, now one possibility you could do is you could write on the Shtar itself, part of it has been paid off. But let's say the Malva doesn't want to do that. Now the Loiva has reason to be concerned. The Malva has a Shtar that says, I owe him $100. Later on, he's going to try to collect the whole thing again. So instead, they arrange that it's going to be deposited with a third party. Now, though, the Malva still wants that the Loiva is going to pay off the rest of the loan. Also, the Rashbam points out another possibility actually would have been to write a shoiver. Another possibility would be that the Malva would write a shoiver for the Loiva that says you paid off $50, let's say. But let's say it was a tircha to do that, and they didn't want to bother with that. So instead, they deposited the shtar with a third party. Omer loy, and the loiva says to this third party, im loy nasati mikanvad yom ploini, if I don't nasati, it says on the side it's supposed to be etain, if I don't pay off the rest of the debt within, let's say, 30 days, or within however many days, ten loy shtare, then you give the shtar back to the malva, and I'll take my chances that he might be able to recollect the whole thing. So is that considered a valid undertaking or not? If the time came, that time that he said, and he didn't end up paying the debt, Rabbi Yossi, I mean Yitin, Rabbi Yehuda, I'm a lo Yitin. Rabbi Yossi says, well, fine, the loiva accepted on himself, and in that case, the shtar should be given back to the malva. So let the shalish, let the third party, let the trustee go ahead and do that. Rabbi Yehuda says no, because, as the Gemara is going to say, this is a matter of asmachta, it's a matter of, it's not a thorough commitment, and therefore Rabbi Yehuda holds, you can't hold him to it. Now, Yavid, you do have a big question about if the Malva gets back the shtar and he ends up possibly collecting the whole debt from it with it to begin with, wouldn't that be a problem? Wouldn't that be a problem of ribis? So the Rimi Gash and the Rashba explain that in this particular case, there's no issue of ribis because he's not really paying extra for the fact that he's delaying the payment, and they have a whole explanation about it. Nevertheless, the Rashba says it's really not the right thing to do. So Lachatzchila, you shouldn't do that. But we're talking about if that arrangement was made, should the shtar be returned or not? Rabbi Yossi says yes. Rabbi Yehuda says no.
In this case, you have this third party who sort of is a witness that he paid already part of it.
So one witness is not enough. Two.
Right, but he can make him swear if you want to take the full thing. I know that I was a third party over here, and the reason why I was a third party
maybe not part of it already. I hear, but it's not necessarily so. The third party might not have been present when part of it was paid off. He was told by the loiva, and the malva that he was told by the loiva, he was told by the malva, whatever, that part of it was paid off. You can't say that in Beis Din. That would be hearsay. Okay, maybe he could because Odissa, it's that he admitted, but even an Odissa has to be in the presence of aiding. You could have, it's possible to construct a case where the Sholish himself is not able to serve as an aid in this. Okay, so the Gemara says, "B'mai kamiflegi." What's the underlying machlokas? Rabbi Yossi savar asmachta kanya. Rabbi Yossi holds that an asmachta is enough to be koina, and asmachta is where a person takes on a commitment that such and such will happen if I do such and such in the future. He's soimach, meloshen asmachta, meloshen soimach, when he makes it tonight that he's going to be able to do it. In the end, it ended up being an onus and he couldn't. When we said in the mission he didn't pay within the amount of time, it wasn't that he decided not to pay. It was some kind of onus that prevented him from paying. So that kind of thing is called an asmachta. There was quite a lot of discussion among Rishonim what exactly is the difference between an asmachta versus a tnai. After all, we do have, you can make a tnai, and that's perfectly valid. So, first of all, what exactly is the asmachta over here? The fact that you're telling him to return the shtar, or the fact that you're telling that you're saying that the fact that he's accepting on himself the potential obligation to pay more. In any case, one of the many differences that Rishonim discuss about the difference between an asmachta and a regular tnai is it depends on is it something that's within the person's capabilities of doing. Tnai, we learn from Bnei God and Bnei Reuven. They're saying if we go and conquer Eretz Yisrael, then Moshe says then we'll give them Eivor HaYarden. That's something that they're capable of doing, going in the front of the army and leading them, as opposed to an asmachta would be where you're making it depend on something that's not in your control. And even that, though, you would still have that, you would also have, though, that when it's a guzma, when it's an exaggerated kind of penalty for not doing it, as over here, where the shtar is going to be returned, and he may have to pay the whole shtar as if he had never paid until now, then that kind of thing, even when it's in his power to pay, would still be considered an asmachta. So, and then again, according to the Rashbam, the point seems to be more that the fact that he fully expected that he's going to be able to do it, and there was an oinus, that's enough to make it as an asmachta. So you have all over Shas this issue of asmachta, whether it's koiner or not. So Rabbi Yehuda saw asmachta lekanya. Rabbi Yehuda holds an asmachta is not enough to make a kinyan, and therefore, he wouldn't have taken on this tenai if he knew in advance that he's not going to be able to do it, and therefore it can't be a valid kinyan, and therefore Rabbi Yehuda says the sholish should not return the shtar to the malva. So the Rambam, by the way, points out an interesting thing when he deals with these halachas of asmachta. He mentions there was a method that Chachmei Sfarad came up with, the Chacham of Spain came up with to work out the matter, to kind of override, to kind of bypass the issues of asmachta. Is they came up with a concept basically where a person writes out a shtar saying I owe you X amount of money, and the deal is, if such and such conditions take place, then he's going to say, I'm not going to hold you to it. But if not, then I have a shtar that you yourself have written that you owe me X amounts of money. And therefore, in that way, it makes it possible to do something like that, which is going to depend on a contingent factor like that, where you don't know whether it's going to happen or not, and not have the issue of asmachta. Because then you have an actual commitment in a shtar that says that I owe you X amount. And then there's other details about that also that I talked about elsewhere in Shas, where it's based in Choshuv, then they could make an asmachta work and so on and so forth. So the method of the Chachmei Sfarad was basically they would have him make a kinyan. Reuven is making a kinyan that I owe you, Shimon, $100. Then we make a kinyan with Shimon saying, listen, as long as such and such happens, then I'm moichel him that debt as of now. And if not, then I'm going to demand from him that $100. So that way, that avoids the issue because the kinyan has been made and he took a full commitment on himself to $100. And on the contrary, Shimon is the one saying that I'm committing that I won't demand it from him if such and such happens. All right, so anyway, so we have a machloikas over here. Do you need that at all? According to Rabbi Yossi, that's not necessary, and a smachta would be enough for a kinyan. According to Rabbi Yehuda, it doesn't work. So the Gemara says, Amar Rav Nachman, Amar Rav Bavur, Amar Rav Halacha ke Rabbi Yossi. The Halacha would actually be like Rabbi Yossi, that an smachta is koine, but he also the Kamei de Rab Ami. On the other hand, when they came to Rab Ami for a din Torah, Omalahu, so Rab Ami said to his Talmidim, "B'chima acha Rab Yechonon melamdenu pam rishono shniya halacha k'Rab Yosi." Given that Rab Yechonon has taught us many times that the halacha is like Rab Yosi, ani ma'aseh, what can I do? I can't argue on it. Nevertheless, the ain halacha k'Rab Yosi. However, the halacha is not like Rab Yosi, but rather like Rabbi Yehuda. Then asmachta is not koine. That's the girsa we have in front of us. Tosfos discusses in some detail that actually the correct girsa would be that Rav Nachman is saying the halacha is not like Rav Yosi. And then on the other hand, Rav Ami would be saying that I would also want to say the halacha is not like Rav Yosi, but what can I do since Rav Yochanan says differently, but ultimately that the halacha is in fact not like Rav Yosi, but rather like Rav Yehuda. Okay. Mishnah says, Mishan nimchak shtar choivoy. If a person's shtar choiv has been erased, So we don't mean that somebody deliberately erased it. We mean that over time the ink has faded and now it got wet or whatever, and now you can't, now it's not what it said is not readable anymore. Mamid olav edim, so he brings edim who know when the shtar was originally written and what it said in it. But Ubaldifne Basin, it comes in front of Basin, but Oisinle Kium, and they write a Kium of the Shtar. They basically write on the original Shtar a statement certifying what it said in the Shtar to begin with. So they write out what it said in that Shtar, the original date of the Shtar and the amount of money in it or whatever, and they write Ish Pliny Ben Pliny, Nimchak Shtore Bien Pliny, that Pliny Ben Pliny's Shtar was erased. And it was dated, Yom Pliny doesn't mean that it was erased on Yom Pliny, means that it was originally dated on Yom Pliny. Pliny with Pliny Adim, and Pliny were the original Adim on it, and then the new Adim sign at the bottom. Tosfos points out that what it makes is, in other words, that now, because if we only had the later Adim, the reason why we need new Adim is because otherwise it would be only a Milval Peh.
Tosfos also points out, now here the Rashbam is saying that the Edom are the one who write out this Nusach. Tosfos says it would actually be Beis Din who does it, because only Beis Din has the ability to write a shtar that's going to take away money from one person to another. But the point is, in other words, like this, we recertify what it said in the shtar. And then it's a valid shtar. So the Gemara says, Tana Rabbanan, Ezehu Kiyumai, what is the Nusach of the Kiyum of a shtar? Actually, as far as the Pliny or Pliny Adav, Tosfos also points out that Rashbam says when you write Pliny or Pliny Adav means that you're writing in the Kiyum, Pliny and Pliny were the original Adim. You also mention in the Shtar the Adim who now are saying we saw the original Shtar. And the idea being that, again, if the Malva, if the Loiva wants to claim that they're false Adim or whatever, he's going to be able to do that, and then therefore we need to know who they were. Okay, so the Gemara says, turning up on Ezo Kiyum, right? How do you write a Kiyum? You write as follows. The most of Tlosa Havena, we three Dayonim were sitting together. Anu Plony, 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 and we name the Edim. Hotzi Plony, Ben Plony, Shtar Mocho Kofanenu. Plony, Ben Plony brought in front of us a Shtar that was erased, that was effaced, where the ink has faded or whatever. Beyond Plony, where the Shtar was dated on such and such a day, Plony or Plony Adiv, and that Plony and Plony were the Adim who signed it to begin with. The Im Kosovoi, who's Kaknu Laidus and Shal Adim, if in addition in the Kiyum it says that we, the new Beis Din, have checked out the Adus of the Adim, we called them in and we interrogated them, the Nimtzei Adus and Mechuvenes, and we found that their Adus is true, then in that case, the Malva can collect the full debt from the original date of the Shtar, the Enes Tzarech Lahavi Raya, he does not have to bring any further Raya about the validity of what it says in the Shtar. So, in other words, normally we say when Edom are signed on a Shtar, Edom achsum al Shtar, Nasa Kamisha Nechkara Edus and Beis Din. It's considered as though their Edus has already been interrogated and investigated by Beis Din. But here, where the original Shtar is faded, and therefore you need to write a new one, then it depends. If the new Beis Din actually calls in the Edim and interrogates them and makes sure that all the facts are valid, then he can collect with it, and he needs no further raya that the Shtar was valid, or that the date is correct, and so forth. If not, then he does have to bring some independent proof about the time of the Shtar, and about the amount of money, and all the other details that were in the Shtar. Otherwise, the loiva has the ability to claim that the shtar is forwarded. Okay.
When all this is being rewritten, the loiva is agreeing to everything. They agree that it owes the money and everything like that.
Well, so that's the thing. We're saying if the Beis Din is going to check out what exactly was written in the shtar, and they're going to bring in the original Edom and interrogate them, then it doesn't really matter whether the loiva agrees or not. The very fact that he had a shtar to begin with, and now we're interrogating the original Edom, means that that's it. So now he has a new shtar, and that's it. Then there's no further raya needed to continue collecting with that shtar. So if not, then when he wants to use that shtar later, he's going to have to demonstrate that the facts that are written in the rewritten shtar are match what it said in the original, and otherwise the loiva can claim mizuya. Next, the Braisa continues, Nikra posel, if the shtar was ripped up, then it's posel. Because then that shows it was ripped up because it's already been paid off or whatever. Niskareya. But if it got ripped up, as the Gemara is going to explain in a second, the difference, kosher, then it's still kosher. Nimchak only tashlish. What happens if the shtar was effaced, if the writing has faded? But you can still tell what it said over there. Only tashlish, or the ink has gotten smeared or smudged. So im rishumei nikar kosher, as long as you can tell what was written there, then it's kosher. Meaning the Yad Ramah describes in particular in the case of Nitashtish, you know how it is, sometimes you have something handwritten and then it gets a little wet and the ink starts spreading, but you're still able to see, it's a little hard to see the shapes of the letters, but you can look closely and you can see what the original shapes were and where it spread out from there. So the Gemara says, Hechi domin nikra v'hechi domin niskareya. What's the difference between nikra and niskareya? How do we know whether it was ripped accidentally or on purpose? So Amar Rav Yehuda, nikra kera shal Beis Din. When we say that there it would be possible, means that it was torn the way that Beis Din does. Niskareya, when it says niskareya, means kera shal Beis Din, means it was torn in a different way that Beis Din does not do.
Well, that pushes back the question, well, in that case, we need to know what kind of rip does Beis Din do to show that a shtar is possible. It means whether the shtar is ripped in the place where the Edom sign and the and or the different opinions among Rishonim, or the date or the and the Toref, which is the essential points of the shtar, who borrowed from who, what amount of money, etc., is called the Toref, as opposed to the rest of the nusach of the standard nusach of the shtar is called the Tofes. So Rabbi Yehuda is saying when those parts are ripped, some or all of them, according to different Rishonim, then it means that Beis Din did it deliberately to show that the shtar is possible. But otherwise, if you have a rip anywhere else, then it would mean that it just accidentally got ripped. Abaya Omer Shesi Ve'erev. Abaya says a Kera Beis Din is where Beis Din rips it lengthwise and widthwise. Now, not that they divide it into four pieces, but rather that they make an X-shaped rip in it along the length and along the width. And that's what Beis Din does to demonstrate that the shtar is invalid. Nowadays, we have that when a get is given. There's always, you want on the one hand that the get has to be given, obviously, and then, but afterwards the wife needs a proof that she was divorced, she can remarry. In general, nowadays, the practice of Bati Dinim is not to give the actual get to the woman for the reason that later on, a later Beis Din might look at it and find something that they find questionable about it, and then you're going to have all kinds of problems of igun and so on and so forth. So therefore, in general, what they do is after the get is written and given to the woman, and then Beis Din has been supervising the whole thing to make sure that everything was good, then they do a Kera Beis Din on it, and then afterwards they give her a document from Beis Din certifying that she received a get, and that document doesn't have the dinim of a get, and therefore nobody's going to look at it and say, hey, wait, this was not written, this letter is not shaped correctly or whatever. So they do that. They do a Kera Beis Din, and that demonstrates that get is now having been given. It's possible. We don't need it anymore, and that way people don't think it was just accidentally whipped.
Looks like.
The Kera Beis Din, as I said, looks like an X-shaped rip in it. They take it, fold it in four, and then they do a rip along one fold and then along the other fold. So it's not divided into four pieces, but you have rips in both directions on it. All right. The Gemara tells a story. Hanhu Arvoid also the Pumbedissa. There were some Arabs who came to Pumbedissa, Dehavoka Ansi, Arosa, De Inchi, and they were grabbing away and stealing people's land. I guess not much has changed with that nationality from then until now. they were powerful people, so they were not only grabbing the land and then holding on to it, but they were forcing the owners of the land to give them their deeds that they had to that land. That way, later on, the owner was not going to be able to come to court and take the Arab to court and say, wait, what are you doing in my land? I have a shtar that shows that I own it. The goy would force the yid to give him the shtar as well. Rabbi Gershom has a somewhat different understanding. He says these Arabs were soldiers on behalf of the king, and he would give them permission when they're coming to town for a while that basically they could take over people's fields in order to have a place to grow themselves crops, to live off the land while they're preparing for war. But in any case, they were forcing the people to give them their status as well. So the owners, the Jewish owners of those fields, came to Abaya. Omrulay, they said to him, Lechi mar shtore, Rebbe, before these Arabs come and take away our shtores from us, take a look at the shtar, v'nlichtev lon mar shtore achrin alei, and Rebbe, you write another shtar for that field. This way, even if the Arab ends up forcing us to give him one copy of the shtar, naktin and chad, we'll still have another one, and eventually we'll be able to take him to court and get our field back. Then we'll have another one in our hand.
Things haven't changed.
Things haven't changed, indeed. Omalahu Sabai tells them, I'd like to, but my Eved Lahu, what can I do for you? The Omer of Safra, Rab Safra said, which we're going to learn in more detail tomorrow, Beis Hashem, Ein Kosvid Shnei Shtoris Al Soda Achas. You never write two Shtoris of sale on one field. Duma Toris Vahadur Toris, because otherwise you might use that double Shtar to commit fraud. So the Rashbam describes, imagine you have Reuven sells a field to Shimon Bachrayus, where, meaning, in other words, if it's taken away from Shimon in payment of a debt to Reuven, then Reuven is going to reimburse Shimon. Now, what happens is Levi comes and collects the field because Reuven owed him money. Now, now Shimon is going to come and try to collect from Lekuchas to pay off for the Achrayos, and he's going to give them one of the shtaris so that he can collect again from the Moicher, and then again he's going to do that with the second shtar. He's going to say that now it was taken away from me in satisfaction of a debt, and now I want to be able to collect again because the rest is the Achrayos, and look, I have a shtar mechira. So there's the possibility of fraud, and therefore you can't do that. We'll learn more in the Gemara. We'll talk about more of the details of that tomorrow, Beis Hashem. But anyway, so therefore, Abaye is saying, I can't write you a second copy of the Shtar. Havokotarudile, so they're bugging Abaye. We really want you to write the Shtar, and never mind that halacha. Now, as we had a previous case like this in our Masechta as well, where there was someone bugging one of the Chachamim, it was Rava in that case, to do something which he didn't want to do, so eventually there comes a point when they're being nudniks like that, you have to kind of fob them off with something. So finally, Omerle the Safre, so Abaye says to his sofer, Zilk Soiv Lahu, go write for them a shtar for this purpose. Where the upper part of the shtar, the body of the shtar, will be written on a part that was previously written and erased, and the edim are going to sign on fresh paper, the posel, and as we learned earlier in the parak, that's posel because then the upper part might be completely erased and rewritten again. You might have a whole new shtar there with the signatures of genuine edim on it. So they're not going to realize that it's posel. So that way they'll take it and they'll be happy. They won't bother me anymore. And then if they actually come to use it in Beis Din, then they'll find out that it's an invalid shtar. So Rav Acha bar Yumi says to Abaye, what good is that going to do? Dumer b'shumay nicker. The problem is, if you have them write a shtar like that and then erase it, what if they don't thoroughly erase the writing that was there, and you're going to see, and then it's still going to be visible a little bit, what it said over there? V'tanya nimchak anitashvesh, and we said before in the Braisa that if the shtar was erased or that if the shtar was rubbed out or smeared or smudged, as long as you can see the original writing that was there, then it would be kosher. So now you have a problem over here. What good is your takana going to do in this case? You write out the whole nusach of a shtar and erase it. As long as some of it might conceivably be recognizable, it'll still be kosher. Granted, it's a little bit far-fetched of a possibility, but nevertheless, you as the dayan have a responsibility to make sure the Ritva points out that the Rabbi Acha bar Yumi is saying, you as the dayan have to make extra sure that you're not doing something that could enable fraud. Omalei, so Abaye answers, Mikamin Shtar Amalya, do you think I meant that on the upper part of the parchment they should write a full-fledged shtar with all the nusach of it? No. Aleph Beis Ba'alma Kamin. All I'm saying is write Aleph Beis, write random words or whatever, and then erase it. The point is, in other words, that later on you'll have, when they write the shtar that these guys are demanding, that says that Pliny owns this, or that Pliny bought this field from Pliny on such and such a date, that will be out of place that was previously written with something meaningless and erased, and that way again, since the age him are on a fresh parchment, then as we learned earlier in the parak, such a shtar is going to be possible, so they'll find that out later, but meanwhile they'll think that they have a valid shtar and they won't bug me. As far as you're concerned, that they might still be able to read what it said there originally. What it said originally there was just going to be random Aleph Bey's letters or whatever, and there's nothing that they can use that for either. So that way we avoid the whole problem.
I would give these troublemakers the second get. I mean, it's the second the second writing, the one that's not clear, and keep the original. This way, I'll come with the original.
No, here the point is, we're not talking about clear and unclear. Here we're talking about they had an original shtar, which they're concerned that the Arab is going to take away from them. So they're
right, to give the Arabs the second copy.
Give the Arab the second shtar. Maybe they could do that. I don't know. That's a good point. Maybe the Arabs might catch on to that, but that is a valid point. But yeah, either way, the point is here, Abaye was just trying to get these guys off his back, so therefore so he's telling them that he's doing like that. What they want to do with the first shtar versus the second, that's their, what they want to do. As far as the Arabs, that's their business. By the way, Mefarshim point out, I mean, another way around it would have just been, the whole problem is when there's Achrayus involved, where again, Reuven sells a field to Shimon with Achrayus, and therefore Shimon is saying later on, if that field was taken away, he has the right to reimbursement for Reuven, or even from other people who bought from Reuven. So, well, as I said, we'll learn about it more in the Gemara tomorrow, Beis Hashem, but again, a simple way around it would just be, write a shtar without Achrayus. The problem is, these people didn't want that. They wanted a shtar that had all the details of the original, Achrayus and all, and therefore the only way for Abaye to get them off his back was this kind of method.
The Gemara was really pre-science when it cited the case of an Arab taking the land
of the Jewish owner. Yep, yep. Not much has changed since then, yeah.